Good morning. Last week, we started with discussing a topic on life's destination. Where do we go from here? I hope that after the session, you have been able to go back and contemplate even further about that question. Some of you may be wondering about what you're supposed to do, what you're supposed to meditate after each session. The idea for doing that is to help all of us while reflecting have, you know, we can absorb what we discuss in the session so that, you know, the things, the concepts, the teachings sink in a little deeper. So please continue to do that after every session. Today, we are going to touch on the important topic and start introducing some features of the teaching and also on teachers, the compilers. Specifically, we are going to talk about the Buddha's lineage and I'm going to introduce two compilers, two teachers who are very important for the work that we are using as a framework for studying Buddhism for these 3 months. That is to say, Atisha and Tsongkhapa. So we're going to talk about the qualities of the compilers and the teaching. But first of all, as an introduction, let us touch a little bit on studying from the sutra versus the commentaries. Now, there are people who absolutely believe that we should go only by the teachings of the sutras because these are words of the Buddha himself, and that the commentaries written by later teachers should not be used. You know, that we should go straight into the sutras. I think we can take this view if really we are able to understand the sutra. If we have that capability to understand the sutra, then of course we can do that. But we must be honest with ourselves and acknowledge that even if we were to go straight into the sutra, for most of us, it is very, very difficult for us to try to understand the Buddha's teaching as outlined or as captured in the sutras. For this reason, if we are able to use the commentaries of teachers or patriarchs throughout the different ages of the development of Buddhism, then I think generally they are more useful. But we must know what to choose. There are a category of commentaries that provide the complete teaching of the Buddha. The work that we have chosen, the Lam Rim, is an example. So even at the secular level, sometimes when we want to study certain discipline or when we are dealing with let's say an organization, we need first of all to be able to have a macro view to see the complete picture. But at the same time, subsequently, we need to go at the micro level to go into the details so that in the case of studying, in the case of practice of the Buddha's teaching, it is useful for us to firstly have a overall view, a complete view of the Buddha's teaching. And then when we get into the practice and the detailed studies, then we need to have the ability to go into the details. So the Lam Rim provides this. It gives us an overall complete picture of the Buddha's teaching. And at the same time, when we go practice, it gives us at each stage of our practice very detailed teachings or instructions on what to do. I'd like to make an observation here. that reason we need this macro and micro view. Even on the Buddha's teaching is this: if you reflect back on the way you have been trying to study, to understand, to practice the Buddha's teaching, many people come across a particular tradition. And in this type of approach, when we don't have a complete view of the Buddha's teaching, sometimes we consider other teachings, other traditions to be non-genuine. So this is a problem if you don't have a macro view. And then also, if you don't have a micro view, if you don't go in the details, it is not going to help us to practice and to study very well. You see, many people come across the Buddha's teaching in a very peculiar way. I think all of us have our own peculiar ways of coming across the Buddha's teaching. So some people are immediately attracted by certain aspects of the teaching, for example, meditation. So they say, wow, this is good, you know, this is what I want to learn. So they go learn meditation, practice meditation. Or some people like Chinese Pure Land practice. So they recite, contemplate, be mindful of the Buddha. And then others come across Tibetan teachers. And then, see, a lot of people, this is not actually something the Tibetans do when they are in Tibet themselves. But today we see many people going to Tibetan ceremonies and only interested in, I think, initiations. And then afterwards, with no foundation, they start their practice. Now, if we approach Buddhism like that, then we may find that after we meditate for a few years, or after we follow the Pure Land teaching or a Tibetan tradition, even for a number of years, we find that our grip is as strong as before, sometimes even stronger, because we become more aware. And our temper has not improved. We become as bad tempered as before. So then we have to ask ourselves, what's wrong with our practice? And I think this has to do with us trying to, you know, we think there is a shortcut, so there is no need for us to build the foundation. So in the Buddha's teaching, there is a story about a man trying to build a penthouse, and then he asked the builder not to bother about the foundation and the lower floors. So it is like that, especially in modern times. People are very impatient, but without the foundation, they straight away jump into certain practices, and this is not going to help them in any way. So if you just refer back to the outline of what we are going to cover for 12 sessions, you will notice that we spend a lot of time on the preliminaries. So after introducing the Lam Rim today, we go on and talk about attitudes to learn and practice the Dharma. We talk about the need to find a teacher, and also the role of a teacher, and also role of a student, the relationship between the two, the preciousness of a human rebirth, the three levels of spiritual application. Now, this is an outline of the three stages as outlined in the Lam Rim teaching, and then impermanence. Now, we spend so much time on all this before we even start an important topic on the refuges. So, truly speaking, our becoming a Buddhist starts when we take refuge in the Triple Gem. And then understanding the laws of karma, and then we go on the intermediate stage of renunciation, and also the Bodhisattva path of developing bodhicitta and practicing the six paramitas. So this is an introductory course for practicing the Buddha's teaching, and we have chosen to use Lam Rim as an outline to help us do that. In terms of the lineage of teachings, we need to understand that everything that we know about Buddhism starts with our original teacher. So just now when we recite Namo Bun Si Si Jia Mo Ni Fo, it means homage to our original teacher, the Sakyamuni Buddha. So it is important for us. Sometimes we forget. We forget about the Buddha. So the Buddha, being very kind, give, sometimes we say, 84,000 forms of teaching, because sentient beings have different types of defilements. So helping all sentient beings, the Buddha gave so many teachings. And you can just compare the Buddha's teaching with other founders of universal religions. In comparison, the Buddha's teaching are very vast. And the Buddha taught for many more years, for over 40 years, compared with other religious teachers. For example, Jesus Christ or Prophet Muhammad. So the Buddha's teaching is very vast. And last week, after the first session, sometimes it's very difficult to have a session like this because there are people who had practiced, who had studied Buddhism for quite a while. They know about Buddhism, but some of you are only beginners. So sometimes I try to avoid using certain terminologies, but I got good feedback last week. Some people later on ask, what is Theravada? So there are terms like this that some of you may not understand. So I have provided you with another set of notes. Originally, I wanted to give only very few handouts, because I like you to take notes yourself. But we can't do that because some of you don't know what to write. You know, Theravada, you don't know how to write down this. So I'm going to briefly go through. This set of slides are used to talk about the three major traditions of Buddhism, but we're going to pick slide number two. For example, the history of Buddhism in India can be divided into four stages. So for about 100 years after the Buddha's Parinirvana, there was no division of traditions or schools. So that we call period of basic Buddhism. Basically, Buddhism just developed in India itself. And then we go into the second period of development of Buddhism, or here described as the first great period of approximately 500 years each. So during this period, Buddhism was introduced into Ceylon or Sri Lanka today, and some Southeast Asian countries. During this period, Buddhism had developed into many, many different schools. Scholars sometimes enumerated 18, even 20 schools. Among the most important is the Theravada school and also the Sarvastivada. Then we come into the second great period for another 500 years. During this period, Buddhism was introduced into China, and from China to Korea, Japan, and Vietnam. During this period, in India itself, it was the period of Mahayana Buddhism. And there are two major traditions here, which we will touch on later on. And then Buddhism had another 500 to 600 years in India itself. During that period, Buddhism was introduced into Tibet, and from Tibet into Mongolia and other smaller countries surrounding it. During this period itself, this is a period of Vajrayana development in India. That is the reason why, this is a historical reason and geographical reason, you know, that Buddhism today, in terms of traditions, has these three. The Theravada Buddhism, sometimes we say Hinayana, Mahayana, and Vajrayana. But strictly speaking, while we can say that the teachings in Southeast Asia now, actually only one school remained, that is Theravada. So it is better to use the term Theravada than Hinayana, because the term Hinayana was invented by Mahayanis. They consider themselves to be a greater vehicle. So I think it is better not to use this term today. Then Mahayana Buddhism and Vajrayana Buddhism, but please don't say that Chinese Buddhism is Mahayana, because Chinese Buddhism has some 13 schools. Some of them are also derived from earlier, what you may call Sarvastivada traditions, from the Abhidharma and from the Vinaya. And similarly, Tibetan Buddhism is not only Vajrayana, but has the Mahayana elements and also the early, especially in the Vinaya. So in the monastic order, there is no such thing as a Mahayana monastic order. It all started from the early schools. So I hope this set of slides, in terms of some Buddhist terminology, may be useful for you. And also, if you don't understand, when we get into the discussion, please start asking some questions so that you clear that. Otherwise, you may not understand what we are talking about all along. Okay? And you can also stop me halfway. Okay, then let's go on to talk about the two important lineages. Actually, this started during the development of Mahayana Buddhism. And if you understand these two schools, the Madhyamika, sometimes the Madhyamaka, and the Yogacara, then I think you have a very, very good grasp of Indian Buddhism. But in terms of the lineage, the historical Buddha or Sakyamuni Buddha gave the teaching of these two lineage firstly to two great bodhisattvas, that is to say Manjushri and Maitreya. And from that lineage, Manjushri lineage, it went down to Nagarjuna. So Nagarjuna expounded the teachings as contained in Prajnaparamita Sutras, or the Perfection of Wisdom. This is a collection of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. This is a very, very huge collection. The big collection in Chinese translation is about this thick, and 10 volumes. So this is the big sutra. And a condensed version, one which is very popular, is none other than the Heart Sutra. It's very short. In Chinese, less than 300 characters. So in the Prajnaparamita, we find the teaching of emptiness. So Prajna is a wisdom. This is a perfection of wisdom. So this is the wisdom lineage, or the profound lineage. And then on the other side, there is from Maitreya Bodhisattva, another lineage of Asanga. Actually, also, Asanga has a brother, Vashabandhu. And this is the Yogacara tradition with the teaching of mind only, Vijnana Matra. And this particular lineage, we call this the extensive lineage, or the method lineage. By this, we mean in order of compassion, loving kindness, compassion, development of a bodhicitta. Here I'd like to relate a story. This is a story about Asanga. He decided to practice very seriously, so he went for a solitary retreat, hoping that in this retreat, with his intensive practice, that he will receive teachings from Maitreya Bodhisattva himself. So he did that for 3 years, and nothing happened. So he wanted to give up. So he decided to come down from the mountain. But halfway, he met one person who was grinding a rod, iron rod. And then he asked the person. The person said, "I'm going to make a needle out of this." So he felt ashamed that he did not have that type of perseverance, that he was going to give up so easily. So he decided to go back to his hermitage and practice some more. Then 3 more years passed and nothing happened. Apparently he felt he didn't make any progress. Then he decided that that was enough. And then for a second time, he came down. And then this time he saw one person who tried to use a duster to dust a piece of rock. And then he said, "What are you trying to do?" So this person said, "This rock is blocking my view. I'm going to flatten this rock. This again gave him the inspiration that remind him that spiritual practice is not easy, so you need the perseverance. So he went back again for the solitary retreat. And for 6 more years, he cultivated very, very seriously. And he didn't even see a shadow of Maitreya. So after 12 years, he said, well, enough is enough. I'm not going to change my mind, you know. So he came down again. And then this time, halfway, he saw a female dog. Well, very sick. This dog is very sick. Yesterday, I made a mistake. It's a sick dog. So he could see worms trying to eat into the flesh, and then he felt great compassion for this. And then he decided to do something about this, that he was going to take this worm out, you know, from the dog's body. But then he reflected, if he were to do that, the worm would die. So he decided to cut a piece of his own flesh. And then he decided to take the worm, but then he realized that if he were to do it with the hands, the worm would be killed, you know, in the process. So he decided to use his own mouth to suck the worm out. And so when he tried to do that, Maitreya appeared in front of him. So he was very, very happy. And then he asked Maitreya, he said, I've been trying to get the teaching from you for 12 years. And now only I see you. But the Bodhisattva said to him, No. I have been with you all these 12 years. It is only because of your own karmic obstacles that you are not able to see me. But, you know, with your generation of bodhicitta and compassion, as he was trying to help that worm and also help that sick dog, you know. So Maitreya appeared. So this is a very touching story about compassion and bodhicitta, and how Asanga received the teaching from Maitreya himself. Okay, from these two lineages, the profound lineage and also the extensive lineage, Buddhism continued to develop in India. And then in the process, sometimes people take to one side, they follow Madhyamika or the Yogacara, and then some of them are even quarreling. But then the great teacher Atisha combined the two lineages. So let me introduce Atisha. Atisha was born in the year 982 in our modern calendar, the Christian calendar. In East Bengal. In fact, it is what we now call Bangladesh. Actually, he was born very near Dhaka, the capital of Bangladesh. He was born into a royal family. And at the time of his birth, there were many auspicious signs. So he was born a prince. And when he was very young, he had developed certain very special qualities. And just like our Sakyamuni Buddha, the parents, especially the king, was very afraid that Atisha would leave the palace. But Atisha could not be prevented from doing that. So he went searching around for teachers, and eventually one of them explained to him that he has to get permission from his parents in order to practice seriously. So then with many followers, they went back to the palace, and for some time they pretended to lose sense, and then the parents eventually gave up, especially, you know, the king and the queen. Say that, well, he is not worthy to inherit the throne, so they allow him to go practice. And from then on, Atisha went to learn from many, many teachers. This was period where Buddhism continued to flourish before it disappeared in India. Sometimes records say that he had more than 50 teachers, some even say more than 100 teachers. But among so many teachers, the two are most important. One, he received the wisdom lineage from Vidyakokila, the younger. Those of you who have opportunity to go into a text sometimes see different names, because there's Indian name and then there's also a Tibetan name. But I'm not going to bore you with all these names. Some of you already find so many Buddhist terminology and names very difficult to follow. So this is one teacher, he received the wisdom lineage. And then people continue to tell him that it's important to learn the bodhicitta, to develop the bodhicitta. And then he wanted to find the best teacher to teach him. And then he was told that there is a teacher, Suwana Dipi, who is in Indonesia. Scholars trace this to Sumatra. So Atisha by that time had himself many followers. So with many of his followers, they went on a sea voyage to go to Indonesia. That voyage took 13 months. They met with different hardships during that voyage, but eventually reached Indonesia and received teaching from Suwana Dipi, in Tibetan, Selingpa. And he stayed in Indonesia for 12 years, learning from this teacher. And eventually, the teacher told him not to stay, asked him to go to the north, to the land of snows. He already predicted his affinity with Tibet. So then he went back to India. You see, Atisha had the capability, he had learned from so many teachers. During those times, there were always debates between Buddhist teachers and other Brahmin teachers, Hindu teachers. Atisha defeated many of these Hindu teachers. So he became very, very prominent, and he was accepted by different schools. All of them accepted him as the leader. There were important monastic centers, and he became abbot of Nalanda. Then on the other side, in Tibet, Buddhism had started to... Buddhism was first introduced a few hundred years ago, and through support of kings, flourished. And then another king objected to Buddhism and persecuted Buddhist teachers. And Buddhism had deteriorated so much that there were a lot of, in terms of tantric practices, there is Buddhist tantra and the Hindu tantra. And a lot of people get involved. A lot of Indian teachers went with the impure teaching and contaminated the Buddha's teaching. So a king, Yeshe O, was very concerned about this. So he decided to do something for the Buddha's teaching, to revive the pure teaching of the Buddha in Tibet. So he sent people to India to seek a good teacher. And then many of them died because of the different climate. But those who survived came back and said, well, the greatest of the teachers is none other than Atisha. And maybe only Atisha had the ability to revive Buddhism. But they couldn't get Atisha. Tibet had a lot of gold mine. So they decided that they would collect enough gold and go make offerings to those abbots so that they would allow Atisha to come to Tibet. And in the process, Yeshe O was captured by a Muslim king who wanted Yeshe O to convert to Islamic faith. But his nephew, Changjub O, tried to help the uncle. And the Muslim king demanded that either they change their faith or pay in ransom the equivalent amount of gold as the weight of the king. So Zhang Zhuk Oh tried to collect lots of gold to try to get his uncle free. But before he could do that, getting enough gold, he went to visit the uncle, telling him that he had already enough gold for the weight of his body, but not the head, you know. So he was going to continue, but the uncle said no. He said, please do not give even a speck of gold to this evil Khan or this evil king. I'm now old and there is nothing more beneficial that I could do with my life than offer it for the benefit of the Dharma in Tibet. So please take the gold and you have already that you have already collected and offer it to Atisha. Please tell him of Tibet's need for his help. Tell him that our need is so great that I have given up my own life in the hope that he will come to Tibet and teach the pure Dharma. Nephew, please do not think of me. Think of Tibet and the Dharma. This is the great Bodhisattva King, Yeshe Oh, who gave up his own life for the Dharma. Because of Yeshe Oh, that Atisha agreed to go to Tibet. But that was with a lot of difficulty because many important teachers would not allow him. So at first he had to tell them he would go for only 3 years, visiting holy places. And then they agreed. And actually Atisha himself was told that if he had remained in India, he would live until ripe age of 92. But if he were to go to Tibet, then he would only live till 72. And he said that, you know, that's okay. It's better for him to go to Tibet where they need the Dharma so badly. He went to Tibet. So when he went to Tibet, Zhang Zhuk Oh, who by that time had become the king, because Yeshe Oh did not have his own son, he requested Atisha. He said, compassionate Atisha, there is a great confusion about correct practice in Tibet. If it pleases you, I request you not to teach on the most profound subjects. Rather, please teach about karma, the law of cause and effect. Please teach us those practices that are most easy to follow and that include the essential meaning of all Buddha's teaching of Sutra and Tantra. So this was the request of Zhang Zhuk Oh. Atisha was greatly pleased with his sincerity and wisdom, and in response he composed the lamp for the path to enlightenment. So this is the first of the commentaries which give the Buddha's teaching in a very systematic stages, step by step, and provide an overall view of the complete Buddha's teaching. So in Tibetan, it's called Lam Rim. It's the first of the Lam Rim text. Then, of course, we have to introduce Atisha. Was born in Tibet, in eastern Tibet, in the province of Amdo. Also, the Chinese province is Qinghai. In fact, His Holiness the Dalai Lama was also born in that province. Tsongkhapa was born in the year 1357. He was born into an ordinary family in Amdo region of Tibet. And he took vows of a monk at a very early age. By adolescence, he had mastered much of the Buddhist teachings and went on to continue his study under great Buddhist teachers of his days. So there were already many Buddhist traditions, such as the earliest schools, the Nyingma school, the Kaju, the Sakya, and also the school started by Atisha was the Kadam school. So he learned from all these great masters, and he later wrote voluminous writings, providing commentaries on almost all the classic texts of Buddhism, and many comprehensive commentaries, most notably the great exposition on the stage of the path to enlightenment. This is in terms of Lam Rim teaching. Lama Tsongkhapa had written three. So the first is the great exposition, and then also there is a medium version and a short version. The short version actually was composed in songs, a poetry form, if you like, verse. So there are from Atisha himself three different teachings on the Lam Rim. Atisha also, because of his scholarship and also his serious practice, he went into intensive retreat many times and achieved great realization. He later on established the Gelug tradition, or the Gelugpa, which became one of the four major schools of Tibetan Buddhism today. In fact, it is the prominent school with the greatest following. Yes. Huh? Tsongkhapa. Sorry, this part is all Tsongkhapa. Okay, thank you for being so attentive. The single purpose behind Tsongkhapa's teaching, debating and writing was to reform Buddhism in Tibet. He was greatly concerned, now this is like Atisha also, he was greatly concerned with the lack of morals and learning in the Buddhist community of his day. He particularly criticized the widespread use of sexual practices among tantrics, which he felt was incompatible with the high monastic ideals transmitted since the time of the Buddha. So the name of the order founded by him, Gelug, actually means virtuous, the virtuous school. So let me explain a little bit. In terms of this particular course, we are actually decided to use as a simple, this is the our current Dalai Lama, the 14th Dalai Lama, His Holiness, the 14th Dalai Lama, has written this Path to Enlightenment. Actually, he gave the teaching in Tibetan and then was translated into English. In this, he used the third Dalai Lama's essence of refined gold. See, after Tsongkhapa, many great teachers continue to explain the Lam Rim teachings, so that it is easier for people at later stages to follow. And amongst very important ones is one by the third Dalai Lama, the essence of refined gold. And the essence of refined gold itself make reference to Tsongkhapa's shorter Lam Rim, that is the song of the stages of the spiritual path. And our Dalai Lama has used the third Dalai Lama's commentary. So it's commentary on commentary on commentaries. The essence of refined gold as the backbone of this teaching that we are using today. So I must explain to you the lineage. Okay, now let us move on to the aspect of the qualities of the teaching. So in terms of the quality of the teachings, there are four. That the Lam Rim reveals how all the various doctrines of the Buddha are non-contradictory. And this is very important. Now, even especially maybe in our modern age where communication is so developed, that it's no longer a case where if you stay in Tibet, you don't know what is happening in China or Southeast Asia. Today, we can communicate. Even traveling by plane takes 10 hours, that is a very long flight, but 4 or 5 hours to go to India. or to go even Tibet. So, like we said at the beginning, sometimes we come across a particular tradition, but Malaysia is very, very unique in that we are a meeting point of different Buddhist traditions. So there is a need for us to understand Buddhism in total, to understand the different traditions. Of course, it is necessary for us to practice one tradition. There are not many atishas and songkapas that can master teachings of so vast traditions. And for most of us, it would be wise for us to select a tradition which is suitable for us and stick to it and practice seriously. Because for us, in this modern age, we are so busy. We have to be very honest with ourselves in terms of practice. But it is also important for us to have a broad understanding of the Buddha's teaching in total. So, secondly, all the various teachings will be taken as a personal advice. So, especially when we come to the different stages. So, the Lamrim contains very detailed teachings that can be used, especially if we have a good teacher helping us. We can use the teachings as contained in the Lamrim to help us practice the different stages through the path of Buddhahood. So this is very precious. And then thirdly, the thought of a Buddha will easily be found. We mentioned this earlier already at the introduction. If we were to go to the sutra ourselves, chances are we will not be able to understand. But if you use a commentary like Lamrim, it makes reference to a lot of sutras. And then if you are more serious, you go into those sutras yourself. And then you will be able to understand those sutras very easily. Compare with just straight go to the sutra. And then you probably misunderstand a lot of things taught there. And then finally, the great mistake of abandoning a lineage of the Dharma will spontaneously be arrested. Now this has to do with if we are not careful, sometimes we slander other traditions. For example, people who come across, when they study Buddhism, come across Theravada Buddhism first, may say Mahayana Buddhism is not the teaching of the Buddha. And then the Mahayanis will come along and say, oh, we are the great vehicle, compared with Arahants, the small vehicle. So they slander each other. And then people who study the Sutra also slander people who follow the Tantra, and people who follow the Tantra do the same. So we must understand that these teachings of the Buddha are complete. They are taught by the Buddha. And if we slander any of them, then we commit very, very heavy karma. So the Lamrim helps us to have a very good understanding. So we don't take a very sectarian approach in Buddhism, which is very important. Okay, let me just read from the third Dalai Lama's work that the Path of Enlightenment has quoted. From the Essence of a Refined Goal. This is chapter 3 on the three qualities of Lamrim. Number 1, it says the Lamrim teaching has four especially great facets. 1. It reveals how all the various doctrines of Buddha are non-contradictory. If one relies upon the Lamrim teaching, all the words of Buddha will be effectively comprehensible. One will see that there are root practices and branch practices, and that there are direct and indirect teachings, all of which aim at creating helpful circumstances along the stages of spiritual development for a practitioner like oneself. Secondly, all the various teachings will be taken as personal advice. the profound teachings of the sutras and tantras, as well as treatises and dissertations written by later masters, and all the levels and branches of practice will be seen as methods to be used to overcome negative aspects of the mind. The significance of all the teachings of Buddha and his successors, from teaching on how to follow a spiritual master up to those on how to perceive the most profound aspects of reality, will come into one's own hand. One will learn how to practice contemplative meditation upon the words of the teachings, and then settled meditation upon the central themes of these words. Thus, all the teachings will be seen in perspective to one's own life and progress. Now, this contemplative meditation in Theravada Pali term is a vipassana. And also, settled meditation refer to samatha. In Chinese, it's zi and guan. So actually, in the greater exposition, Tsongkhapa give a special chapter on samatha and vipassana meditation practices. Okay, thirdly, the thought of Buddha will easily be found. Of course, the original words of Buddha and those of the later commentators are pure teachings, but for a beginner, they are overwhelmingly numerous, and consequently, their meaning is difficult to fathom. Hence, although one may study and contemplate them, one probably will not gain experience of their actual essence. Or even if one should gain it, a tremendous effort and extent of time would be required. However, because the Lamrim tradition has its source in Atisha's lamp for the path to enlightenment, which incorporates all the various oral teachings of the supreme Indian masters, even someone like oneself could easily and quickly arrive at the thought of Buddha through it. And finally, the great mistake of abandoning a lineage of Dharma will spontaneously be arrested. When one realizes the intent of Buddha, all his direct and indirect teachings will be seen as wise and skillful means for satisfying the diverse spiritual needs of the variety of beings. To say that some lineages of Dharma are perfect methods and should be practiced, whereas other lineages are imperfect and should be ignored, is the karma called abandoning Dharma. A great negativity indeed. However, if one studies the Lamrim, one will see how all doctrines of Buddha and lineages coming from him are non-contradictory. Then the great mistake of abandoning an aspect of Dharma will never occur. This is from the third Dalai Lama. Finally, I just make a comment about how we can even use the Lamrim as a framework for our study and practice of the Buddha Dharma, even if you follow any Buddhist traditions. For example, my main practice is the Pure Land practice, but I find in the Lamrim a very, very good framework to help me do my Pure Land practice. The initial stage, the middle stage, and the higher stage is very, very useful. And the preliminary teachings are also very, very useful, that are maybe not so well expressed in the Chinese Pure Land teachings, are very well done in the Lamrim framework. So one can benefit by this. Of course, the lum room is complete in itself. Now, if your affinity is with the lum room tradition, the Tibetan tradition, then you can follow it. You can follow it. It also has the tantric aspect. But the most of it is a common aspect that can benefit all other traditions and schools of Buddhism. Okay, now we should break into small group discussions.